them then to obtain.
Conference record has joined the conference.
BNPCs and hospitals, so you're not the out. You're not stealing their money. So my feeling was his opposition to redirecting the program would be the existing. But I know, for instance, the classified, there's a small clinic, the Asian Pacific Islander program. Teresa told me that half of all patients are undocumented, uninsured. So,
Thank you. me about this.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'll talk to you later.
My God. Is anybody on the phone? Anybody on the phone?
I'm here. I'm in the opening office, but I spent a great deal of my time here.
I don't hear anybody.
I don't mind.
Okay. And the lights are green, which I mean, which must mean the line's open. Hello? Oh my God, really? How come nobody's on here? Does anybody know who this is for?
I was on the phone the whole time.
Say it again.
No, you know that.
Hi, can you hear us on the line?
They've been on for 19 minutes?
Yeah.
I came on the train.
They should be able to respond, yeah. That's the only train you could get. Here. Yeah. It was sold out, but I mean, Hello, can you hear us?
Right. Can you talk about what they're Good meeting with you yesterday.
Good.
We're not. This one has some.
Oh, I don't know. Where are we with the phone?
President and CEO of some.
I guess we can tell she's not here. The name tag's over here.
I don't know. I think these folks were trying to get a hold of something.
You want to try dialing back
into the dialing? We can. I think Sherry went upstairs. You want to just get started and we'll try, I guess.
I got an email from somebody who says, we are on the phone, the lines are muted, that's why you can't hear us. When we signed in, the recording said the call was on lecture mode and would be muted until the leader changed the settings.
Oh, they...
So they can hear it then. It's not.
Well, that's simple. Just change the settings.
But the idea is...
Well, four members will be able to speak.
Right.
So I maybe...
Okay.
They can hear at least the beginning.
Okay.
We actually want it muted because if not, we hear too much.
Right.
Okay. And there are work group members on the phone.
So did you hear that, Kathleen?
I didn't. I'm sorry.
Someone emailed saying that we have to change the format because obviously ours is muted. So.
Okay.
Well, they say they're on. They can hear, but they can't speak. They're muted.
Okay.
At least they can hear.
Well, that's good. I have Sherry. Coming back down because I think I'm going to be scribing for you, so I'll have her manage that. She should be right in.
What we want because they can.
Mm-hmm. Well, except for the members. There are four work group members on the phone who won't be able to participate. Well, I get.
Probably by the time we get.
Okay.
We'll get them on.
There they are.
Well, there are two of them. Good morning.
You were not on the train the other
day. No, I wasn't.
we actually
we're having a little train trouble. Okay. Good morning, everyone. We're going to start. I apologize, 15 minutes late, but next meetings we're going to start right on time before we end on time. First and foremost, I want to welcome everyone here to Oasis, and also thank you all for agreeing to participate in this extremely important subcommittee of the MRT. Especially those of you that have traveled. I know it's not easy getting here. I'm so used to the trains being problematic, so I came up the night before. I don't want to go through those issues anymore. But there are some members of the committee that are not here, and I understand that the train this morning, the 7:10 train, was sold out, so they have to stay behind and take, you know, the next train. So they're going to be a little late. So we're going to start anyway, and when they do come, you know, they'll join the group. There are people online that could call in. They cannot participate, but they could hear the discussion, similar to the folks in the audience who are here, cannot participate in the discussion, but are here to hear what goes on. Having said that, you know, let me just put a little perspective on this whole subcommittee. As you're very well aware, one of the key elements of Governor Cuomo's budget this year was to identify ways that we could reduce cost and increase quality in the whole Medicaid system. As a result, in January, I think it was January 5th, he issued an executive order ordering the redesign of New York's outsized Medicaid program. Out of there, the team of, I believe it was 20.
The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted.
I didn't realize that. It was going to be interrupting. I'm sorry.
And the order called for this team to come up with savings in the Medicaid program in total of $2.35 billion, while also, you know, ensuring quality care. As a result, we had stakeholders from all different areas. We received over 4,000 ideas and proposals, of which some were enacted, that would help move the $2.35 billion decrease in the Medicaid. This committee is actually one of the committees that came out of those proposals. The intent and my hope really is that, you know, we come up with some critical reforms that will reduce the healthcare disparities, right? But also improve patient outcomes and do it in a manner that is ongoing. That's really the intent of this meeting here. I want to stop now, and I want to turn it over to my co-chair, Elizabeth Swain, for her to also give you her.
Well, welcome, everyone. I'll be quick. First, I wanted to thank Governor Cuomo and all of my colleagues on the MRT, my co-chair, Commissioner, and the staff at the state, who I know is working 24/7 to support all of this work, and many others for the opportunity to co-chair this important work group. Welcome to all of you who are on the work group. I'm really pleased that you've all accepted the invitation to be on, and I look forward to working with all of you. Health disparities have developed in this country for reasons that I think many of us are all too familiar with. The health system is not a system at all, but rather a collection and array of private businesses that are run to produce outcomes for the businesses, but not necessarily for the people. You know, disparities have unfortunately become, you know, a sort of a a cliche or catch term for a euphemism for what we all know is broken about our non-health system. And of course, every system is perfectly designed to produce the outcomes it produces, and that's our job is to change the system so that it produces the outcomes that we want it to produce. Sounds incredibly easy, but it's been many of our life's work, and it's, you know, it feels like things have gotten much worse in the last 30 years. So we've looked at disparities for decades. There's so much to say about what it means. And the challenge for all of us is really going to be to set aside the reams of data that we know we have access to and figure out some focus for the work that we're doing in the next few months that's going to produce something meaningful in the context of the larger Medicaid redesign work that we're doing. And I think, you know, that's going to be our largest challenge. We're going to spend a lot of time today trying to develop some early focus. You know, we all have significant challenges in our day jobs. I think that we bring all of those challenges and expertise to this table. And I just wanted to thank everybody for being willing to do this work, to do the hard work of creating some focus and actually, you know, producing something that we can consider meaningful and consider to be proud of. So thank you. Thank you, everybody.
At this point, I think it merits going around and for all of you to introduce yourself and say why you're here, you know. And one important thing I'm going to ask from each and every one of you is to give me your top reason, your top focus on what you would like to see as a result of this subcommittee. What's the one thing that you're really looking forward to address?
Okay. And I'll go ahead and capture those up here.
Right. I know you'll have many, but think about it. I think you'll want to focus on which way we're going.
Hi, I'm Gus Burkhead with the State Health Department. Along with Karen Westervelt, I'm the co-staff lead to the committee. So I have lots of ideas, but I'm not actually a member of the group, so I'll pass.
Karen Westervelt, State Department of Health, and I've recently been appointed to the Department of Health to create a new office of primary care. While I'm not a member of the MRT, you know, what we do in primary care has to, you know, be considered.
Hi, I'm Lauren Tobias. I'm also with the Department of Health with the Division of Financial Planning and Policy. I've been involved on a staff level with the Medicaid redesign process, and in particular working on the Health Homes Initiative, which I'll be speaking about later today. So I'm not a member of the committee. I was asked to speak today, but I know many of you, and I've been starting to work with many of you, and I look forward to and meeting the rest of you.
Good morning. Hope Plays, and also for the State Health. I work for the Office of Public Health. It's Dr. Burkhead, and I'm here.
My name is Susan Dua, and I'm Executive Director of the Center for Independence of the Disabled in New York. We serve people across all disabilities in New York City and find that they face enormous barriers to access to care and face gross disparities in outcomes as well. The Department of Health's own data has documented this, and I'm sorry that that material isn't before you today. Because it shows increased rates of smoking, drug and alcohol use, obesity, a lot of the things that concern us in terms of disparities are more prevalent among people with disabilities. And so it is my hope that we will look in an inclusive way at how to address disparities and create greater health equity. I hope that we will focus on how through existing programs and more efficient use of existing models and resources, we can eliminate barriers to health access and to improved health outcomes and achieve greater health equity. Certainly many of the changes made in the state's budget as a result of the Medicaid redesign process have negative implications for health access for people with disabilities. However, there are some sterling opportunities to actually improve health. Among them, our approach to data collection, looking at opportunities to address the organization of health homes and other models of care that could be made accessible for people with disabilities with some thought and energy on our part. And I hope that we will focus on very concrete solutions and an action agenda that we can actually follow to see how the concerns that we have are being addressed as the state moves forward with Medicaid.
Good morning. My name is Pam Mattel, and on my card here it says that I work at Promessa Systems. So I'm going to take the opportunity to talk about our rebranding. We have a new name called Acacia Network. We are located primarily in the South Bronx, however, provide services throughout New York City in four main areas: primary care, behavioral health care, mental health, substance abuse, housing, and economic development. We serve about 14,000 people a day. And I really appreciate the comments that both the Commissioner and Elizabeth shared. My primary reason for being here, actually, I'm going to try and put a few together. You said one, so I may take a little liberty.
I already have broken the rule. Maybe three.
I can still be brief, however. So I'm mostly interested in transformation of community from a systemic perspective. Been really interested in the work that's coming out of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement on their triple aim, which is about population health, patient experience, and cost per capita. And I think that's very relevant, particularly for the Bronx. There is an inordinate amount of services, but the health disparities continue to increase. So I think that there's a mismatch. And I think part of the mismatch is that there tends to be more of a hospital-centric approach to healthcare, and the groups that we're talking about really need a community-based centric approach. I talk about that in pretty much all the forums that I'm at, so I'm interested in promoting that, particularly when we're thinking about un- or underinsured immigrant populations, where it's not really clear about how they can access culturally meaningful health care. So I'm here for those and many other purposes.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jonathan Lang. I'm the Director of Governmental Projects and Community Development at the Empire State Pride Agenda, which is New York statewide LGBT civil rights and advocacy organization. LGBT is lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. It's all incorporated into our vocabulary and move forward. One of the things that I am here to be a part of and to raise the issue is about LGBT health. Unfortunately, there isn't a lot of information out there because there's not a lot of data collected on the needs of LGBT people. In 2009, the Pride Agenda commissioned the first ever statewide needs assessment, and we saw some very alarming health disparities impacting LGBT New Yorkers, particularly around transgender New Yokers. And so I'm here to raise the specter of LGBT health and human services wherever possible and make sure that we're expanding access to Medicaid to include some of the more underserved communities in New York State. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Joe Buford. I'm president of the New York Academy of Medicine, and our focus is on urban health and work on healthy aging, prevention, and eliminating health disparities. Being involved in this group is a really great opportunity. We work very upstream, really looking at how to prevent the kinds of problems that people have before they get into the healthcare system. So we're looking at environmental change, community change, multi-sectoral engagement, transportation, housing, education, socioeconomic development. And I think this opportunity for me is to try to see how we can leverage the healthcare system, which is where the money is and where the policy attention is, to get significant attention to disparities and to improving the conditions in communities. So I would really like to see, some statement come out of high-level political support for attention to disparities, and similarly, I'd like us to really try to think about how to embed at state level issues in the IT changes that are being made, in the reimbursement system, in the benefits package, that institutionalize disparities. I think if we keep it on the side as a special initiative, we won't. We've been there, done that for a long time. So I think it's going to be a challenge, but the opportunity is very exciting. So that's what I'd like to see is state level change. I'd say also there are a number of national plans. CDC has a disparities plan, HHS has a disparities plan, and I think the National Quality Improvement Strategy articulates disparities as a quality issue. And so I think there are a lot of guideposts we could use for state level change. I'd like to see that help us inform our work.
My name is Neil Kelman. I'm a family physician, and I am president and CEO of the Institute for Family Health. We're no longer urban. It's hard to lose part of your name. So, we operate centers in Bronx, Manhattan, and Ulster and Dutchess counties, mostly primary care centers with some limited specialty, working in hospitals, and also train residents in two family medicine resident training programs. My interest in disparities started about 15 years ago when we had opened our fifth health center in the Bronx and were looking at the community statistics and felt like if we didn't do something different, that I would have spent my entire life training doctors and opening health centers in an area without impacting one iota what the health outcomes of that community were. And so we got involved in a grassroots effort that now involves about 60 community-based organizations to look at what it is about the healthcare system that keeps people from being able to get care. And it encompasses a lot of the issues that all of the rest of you have spoken about already, and I'm sure that we're going to talk about. But the part that interests me the most is the structural things that we've done in the healthcare system that basically create multiple classes of care, that basically allow our hospitals and institutions to run private practices side by side with clinics and operate them completely differently, that allow the Medicaid, the partnership plan that was supposed to bring everybody into sort of a private model of care, not to have actually transitioned to care for many people. And I'm fearful as we move forward to bring all the rest of the vulnerable people into managed care that haven't done what we need to do to sort of create models to monitor their access. So from my perspective, we have to be willing to really do some of the hard stuff with the healthcare delivery system, put new requirements on that system so people actually communicate and do the things that people have done when they have private insurance and when they go to places where people actually, care about taking care of them. So that would be my first goal. And my second would really be to see a larger involvement of the communities involved in the decision-making. I guess I would describe this as bringing back some sort of local health planning effort so that we stop having teams of people dropped into communities to decide what's good for them and what should be done, and basically have efforts that sort of evolve from the community, similar to what we've been doing in the Bronx, where people bring their stories and their problems, and some sort of effort evolves from that helps to determine what the needs of that community are. So far, those ideas don't have any teeth, but we can give them teeth by basically allowing them to be part of some sort of resurgence of health planning effort that would start at a community level and sort of grow up from that. And I think if we have some good outcome that could come from be a recommendation of the reintroduction of a community-based, and that would help to figure out what the needs are in various underserved communities and populations of people that that could move us forward.
Hi, good morning, everybody. Emilio Carrillo. I'm an internist and associate professor of clinical public health and medicine at the Weill Cornell Medical School. I'm also the health at New York Presbyterian Hospital. I think there's a few things that we might want to focus on. I think the first is metrics. If you can't measure it, it's not there. If you can't measure it, you can't improve it. So I think that it if this committee took a look at what measures are available for disparities and also for cultural competence, I think that it would be very great contribution that we could do. These measurements could go into the HEDIS-QAR system, it could go into the CON system, it could go into multiple systems that are touched by the state of New York. I sit on a couple of committees for the National Quality Forum where these issues are front and center, so hopefully I'll be able to share with the group some of the work that's going on in Washington at a national level that deals with the measurement of disparities and cultural competence. I think that the issue is not hospitals or community or nursing homes. The issue is a regional approach, that we have multiple stakeholders represented here. We have multiple sectors in our healthcare system. And as the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has been doing now for some years, looking for ways in which payers, the feds, private insurance, can work together with the elected officials, work together with the various agencies and groups in the communities to create a regional approach that that basically serves to improve the health of the community. I agree with Neil. The state should allow the blending of private and Medicaid patients in similar spaces. It's something that a New York Presbyterian we've been pushing for some time. We've spoken with the Commissioner Shaw on this issue, and perhaps this is something that would be moved on by this committee. I think that would be for many. Also, that we look at the HEAL processes, the HEAL grants. We have the HEAL 9 is one of the various efforts by the state that are looking at how to rethink health planning and how to rethink the CON process in the context of health planning. So I think that the idea of bringing back the health planning perspective that is enhanced by IT. So I look forward to a lot of good work, and I think it's going to be a good show.
Rosie Moses, from Paranegal Network. I represent a group of community-based social health providers, and our perspective on health disparity is founded on the sense that there are several determinants in our community, and the healthcare system or non-system is part of it. And a big piece of the determinant is the availability, is the equitable distribution of finance to keep our providers in the game, in the safety net game. And we know that the reducing Medicare care costs is not only going to depend on what happens in the system when the person becomes sick, but what happens before to help keep people out of the system. And our community-based primary care providers in the community share an unusual burden of illness because of the community. And that is hardly ever considered when we're looking at how we cut, slash, and burn the system. And I'm hoping that my engagement here, which for me is a burden given the fact that I'm already overloaded at a community-based operation that is barely adequately funded, if adequate is the word. But I've decided to take this on because I feel that I can bring an unusual input from an unusual population that usually doesn't have a voice in here. So I'm hoping that in return for participation here that the work that this group does will be taken seriously and our presence would not just be leveraged to endorse something that we may not really agree on. And that's really a very serious concern for me, and I want to say it up front. I don't want to be here and then my time is wasted and, you know, it's like, you know, you were here, so you want to say that up front. The other thing that we're very concerned about is that in Brooklyn, our health system is falling apart, and any cuts to Medicaid that don't hold up already fragile system without thinking of the impact of the flood, the availability of quality services, and I'm hoping that I can bring the kind of input that helps to balance, you know, the information that will be used to make those decisions for cuts and keep focused on why we need to hold certain populations harmless as we think about how we do those cuts.
Okay, before we go on, can I just ask the folks on the phone to please mute your phones because we're getting a lot of interference. So folks, mute your phones now.
Can I just make a suggestion for the folks that are on a call? Is it possible of maybe just going back on a lecture mode and if any of us on the on a call dialing in, if we have any questions, we can email those questions? Because otherwise, there's probably going to be a lot of interference throughout the day.
Well, if you have any questions, we weren't going to entertain questions on the phone. Just for people to hear.
Okay.
It might be
wise then just to go back onto the lecture mode, so then this way, you know, everyone could still listen, and then this way it would not be
right.
Interruptive in terms of any potential background noise.
It was my understanding that there were work group members on the phone. Therefore, they wouldn't be able to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe we can finish the introductions and then do it. Yep.
Okay. Look forward. Okay, I'm sorry. Just want to react to something you said, though. Please be assured the committee is not a committee just to jot down ideas and stroke anybody. This is a working committee. The governor, as well as myself and the co-chair, takes this committee extremely important and seriously. So that's why we've gathered here, to gather the concerns and hopefully propose items that will be addressing the disparity in our community. I've worked in health disparities myself. It's not something that's new to me. And I'm very cognizant of the fact that this is a two-way street as well. We always talk about providers, but we need to talk about the recipients of care. We need to also incentivize both sides. Not just incentivize the provider to provide the adequate care and reach out to our communities and provide the care that is needed, but we also have to incentivize our own recipients, our own individuals, so that they will access the care once it's there. So I thank you for those comments, but I felt strongly to respond.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Jackie Mo. I'm the Director of Advocacy at the New York Immigration Coalition. We're a coalition of about 200 immigrant organizations statewide. We work on a range of different advocacy issues, from civil rights to housing to health care to education. And my two priorities, and I'm not going to take the liberty of doing two, disparities in key immigrant populations are well documented. The language access is obviously a large priority for us. The Medicaid reimbursement for language assistance has been discussed, but I hope that we can actually go beyond that one item, have a broader discussion about language assistance. That would be the minimum bar that I would hope that we would get to, and I hope that we can have a more far-reaching approach to language assistance than just the Medicaid reimbursement, which has been discussed, and which I hope is would be a done deal. And then the second piece would be about uncompensated care, really looking at creating a formula for equitable distribution of charity funds. As we know, a lot of these funds go to fund things other than direct services for the populations that we're working with, and we really want to be, one of our suggestions, and that we want to recommend quite strongly is that the funding should follow the patient, that there needs to be accountability for charity care services, and we need to look at the way that we're funding uncompensated care, and in particular with the subpopulation of undocumented immigrants.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Noelan Abasamas Mendoza. I'm with the Coalition for Asian American Children and Families. We are too a coalition of about 45 organizations that serve the very diverse Asian Pacific American community, mostly in New York City. I'm prioritizing three things that I'm interested in the work group to think about. I echo what Jackie was saying. language assets. Oftentimes, the plans that go out there really are talking about maybe three of our languages. And so we're very much concerned about limited English proficient populations, particularly those that are in small but growing communities. Common, but they definitely do have needs, and we see that from our community members when they're trying to access care. Some other folks mentioned data collection. I'm really happy to see that Asian Americans are included here, because oftentimes when we see reports, I totally echo you, Jonathan.
Glaring omission.
Yes. We are often invisible, and I hope that we would actually go further and think about disaggregation of data. You can lump many of these groups, but we really have to look, I think, at a more granular level, because we'll see very different disparities among different groups. And then I think, the third aspect is really looking at developing a more robust, diverse workforce, particularly those that are bilingual and bicultural. Our community members might be able to act as a primary care provider who speaks their language, who understands their culture, but then when we start thinking about long-term care or specialty care, that's where they see a lot of difficulty getting culturally competent care. So I hope that we will be discussing these issues.
Hi, everyone. My name is Theo Shiro. I'm the Director of Health Advocacy at Make the Road New York. Make the Road New York is a community-based and membership-led organization based in New York City, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island specifically, and recently opened an office in Long Island as well. We have a membership now, over 9,000 Latino, mostly Latino immigrants who are members of our organization, and our organization's mission is to create spaces where immigrants, and specifically Latino immigrants, can speak out on the issues that most matter to them and actually take action. So we do this in the areas of parents and schools, youth and schools, workplace and labor issues, civil rights issues, housing issues, and LGBT issues as well. I think one of our main areas is healthcare and health access. And particularly, we've done a lot of work around language access, as some of my colleagues have done, working to engage hospitals and now pharmacies to provide, vital interpretation and translation services to help eliminate the barrier between patient and doctor, patient and pharmacist, so that they can meaningfully access healthcare in a language that they can understand. I think personally, as an immigrant myself, and seeing my family and friends struggle through the healthcare system, it is a broken system right now, and we need to do work to, as some of my colleagues have said, engage the community and in not a top-down approach, but the communities as partners. Someone mentioned a hospital-centered approach, but I think we love to have hospitals as partners, but we also want community members themselves at the table as well. I'll echo some of the things on language access. We really want to see reimbursement for these services that are crucial services that are provided in hospitals and clinics and should be compensated to those facilities. And not only hospitals and clinics, but also pharmacies, which have the duty to provide these services already but are not getting paid for them. We also have a huge opportunity. The bad news about health reform is that there are a lot of people still uncovered, particularly undocumented immigrants all over the country. And I think New York State has an opportunity here to do the right thing and help these immigrants, participate in the system and be able to not only access services but also contribute to the system that they're already a part of. I think that it's vital that we look at this from a community perspective, and I'm glad I've heard a lot of that around the table this morning. So thanks.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Nisha Agarwal, the Director of the Health Justice Program at New York Lawyers for the Public Interest. We are a nonprofit civil rights organization based in New York City. We provide technical, legal, and organizing support to community-based campaigns around New York. And the Health Justice Program in particular is focused on racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare, addressing things like immigration status, language barriers, and how race also impacts people's ability to access high-quality care.
For this, and we also have a disability practice as well, and I'm hoping to channel some of my colleagues to be able to amplify some of the concerns about disability-based inequalities in the healthcare system here as well. In terms of our goal, I'd like to echo what others have said. I think that there's some low-hanging fruit that we could really tackle in this committee, like the Medicaid reimbursement for language services, doing it in an accountable way so that the money actually goes to providers who provide the services. But I think our real hope in being here would be to address some of the structural challenges that really contribute to disparities. So looking at policies at states and at providers that may seem race neutral on their face but actually impact vulnerable communities, things like what Neil mentioned about separate facilities for publicly insured and privately insured patients, which fundamentally impacts quality of care for Medicaid individuals. And then also looking at the broader sort of state systems. So can this committee maybe think about looking at the rest of the MRT process and other state policies to evaluate it for you know, whether it's exacerbating or ameliorating disparities issues? Something like a disparities impact assessment might be an interesting concept to think about. And then finally, a third goal would be process-based, and this is really one of the first MRT committees that I think is very diverse in many respects, and I'm hoping we can leverage that to bring the perspectives of the various constituencies that we're standing in for here today by bringing more information to the table to inform our discussions beyond what the state is able to provide as well. So I think that's really something I'd like us all to commit to.
My name is Diana Babcock. I work with Mental Health Empowerment Project. I'm a dual recovery peer specialist. We're a nonprofit peer-run group. Honestly, this is the first time I've ever done anything like this, so I'm listening and I'm learning. But I do know that I would like to see access to whatever the needs the person has right from the beginning, not after the fact. I would like to see when it comes to, like, primary care doctors being able to have the time to talk to the person and know who they are, what they're struggling with, what their family issues, things like that that are going on, if there are addiction problems, if there is some type of mental health, finding more and more that it's related to trauma, and I think that that's an important thing. When it comes to community, very much about community and getting out there and talking to people, finding out what they need, advocating, telling them where they can go, things like this, and I'd like to see more of that incorporated into everything that's being done here so that people realize that they have a voice and that they do have rights and that they can advocate.
I'm Charles King, Housing Works, and I've been actively engaged in advocacy around healthcare disparities since my involvement in ACT UP New York 25 years ago, where there was a big healthcare disparity around the AIDS epidemic, and then in helping to found Housing Works, which was the first organization in New York State to house people who were actively using drugs without putting conditions on their drug use. I come to this table with, I guess I could put it in two buckets, can't possibly do one, and I'm really cheating with the second bucket. The first bucket, if you think about the MRT process, as I understand the charge, it was to save Medicaid dollars by improving healthcare outcomes. And I think some of the MRT proposals that were enacted just saved dollars. Some of them probably worsened healthcare disparities, but I also think some of them offer a tremendous opportunity in and of themselves to improve healthcare disparities. So I'm very hopeful about things that help and some of the possibilities around long-term managed care and other things that can come out of this. So I guess my first interest in this work group is really looking at the MRT proposals that are of coming forward and really using this work group to ask the hard question of these proposals. Are they ameliorating healthcare disparities or exacerbating? Because the truth of the matter is, if we do Medicaid reform right in New York State, that should be the single largest solution to healthcare disparities. And I think it's important that you get it right. The second is that, let's say that works, and Medicaid reform does tremendously ameliorate healthcare disparities. Who's been left out of that process? Who hasn't been impacted in a meaningful way if that system does work? And, you know, I have my short list. Some of them have already been mentioned. I came with a proposal in his pocket. So, one group is people who are chronically chemically dependent. I think even in the context of health homes, unless we change our regulations around drug treatment to offer harm reduction, unless we do a massive campaign around hepatitis C, we're still going to see tremendous health disparities in that population. Certainly undocumented immigrants, and love to see us come forward with supportive housing for undocumented immigrants who have chronic conditions, who are presently kept out of all of the existing supportive housing systems. LGBT population and there, I echo the tremendous health disparity for transgender people, but also seniors and the very young. I don't think the MRT and HIV and sexual health getting diagnosed with HIV when they're getting diagnosed, and I'm that homeless people with chronic conditions, and you know, it's very ironic to talk about health home for people who don't have a safe, secure place to live. So I think that I know there's going to be another work group on that, but I think that certainly contributes to healthcare disparities. And I'm also interested in the data collection issue. One of the things that I noted, I sit on the board of the National Haitian American Health Association, and one of the things that we struggled with there is just that nobody collects, I think some other people mentioned this, nobody collects data on Haitian Americans or Haitian immigrants. They get lumped in with blacks or African Americans, and I think somebody mentioned you'll actually see if we break these populations down that there are tremendous variations in experience and a need for and I echo with Susan, people with disabilities and the need to bring them in the system. And frankly, I think out of all the populations talked about in the MRT process, I think it's probably the case that people with disabilities are probably the people who hold the least benefit and possibly the worst potential harm. And I think we need to think about that in a serious way.
I'm Rosa Gill, and the president and CEO of Coming Live Inc. And we are a multi-service health and human services not-for-profit. We provide care a year through supportive housing for persons living with HIV/AIDS and seriously and persistently mentally ill patients. In addition, we offer affordable low-income housing for those who are not living with chronic illnesses. And we have a very large mental health clinic, particularly in the Bronx, although we have programs in all the boroughs except Staten Island. And I did see a little bit having a little bit of a deja vu. In 1997, together with Commissioner Barbara De Bono, we rolled out the Medicaid managed care in the state of New York, and that was part of the
major, and I sit here learning something about what has happened with Medicaid managed care in this state. I am obviously interested in health disparities, and that through my career I have attended to address the issues impacting quality of care for certain populations in New York City and New York State, and almost also in the country. And not too long ago, probably within the last year, the HSS issued a report where there have been a little bit of improvement in the health disparities among African Americans. However, for the Latino community or the Hispanic communities in the country, rather than a little bit of an improvement, we have gone down on those indicators. And equally important is immigrants, like you were mentioning, Charlie, patients and all the immigrants that have been mentioned here in the poll. I do thank the governor and the both chairs for inviting me to participate in what I consider to be a really hard rock to break. We have been living with health disparities in this country for too long. If we compare ourselves to other countries in the world, I think it's shameful that we continue to have these health disparities in this country. I was just reminded of that on a trip that I took to Dubai and Middle East countries, where I saw their health disparity, and even their health disparities, but they are very different in nature from what we have here. You know, if we're going to be serious about it, and I think that we are all serious about this work, that we don't do what I have seen my colleagues in academia, that we take cultural diversity and we put it in a course. And have integrated in the whole curriculum. And I think that if we were to do that again here, that we are not going to see the progress that we are all interested and invested to change things around. I see that the chairperson of the translational research findings at NYU School of Medicine, and I'm always questioning why is it that we really have to translate research to our community when community is not at the table. So if we were to start these health disparities by talking about how can we enable, how can we infuse this process by having community define concerns about their disparities to be able to put into a format that we have the community around this table represented. Rather than having to translate later the findings, so community quote will buy into it at the end of the process, rather than at the very beginning of the process, that maybe we can think of incorporating some of the colleagues around the table already have identified the need to have community participation or to take into account those concerns. And talking about community-defined best practices, I think that we need to look at those issues. And just that among this distinguished group of colleagues, I don't see, and maybe I missed this in reading the participant, but I don't see a Medicaid managed care organization on the table. And I think that Medicaid managed care organizations are going to be crucial, as they have been in the years since these have been policy here. We have on our doorsteps by September 1st, we all have to, or some of us will be part of the health homes. As we think of health homes, how are we going to integrate the health disparity? And that's something that I would like, for me, is a short-term goal. How are we going to impact the decisions about health homes that should infuse themselves with regulations and practices that will ensure the reduction of health disparities as we roll out by October 1st the health home? So
I think it's a high task for us between now and then, and I guess that our colleagues in the Department of Health will be very busy reading all these health homes after September 1st. So I hope that a little bit of today's meeting will help us to put a little bit of caveat here. And just not too far after September 1st deadline, we have the VHOs who are coming down online, I think, on October 1st. And basically, how are we going to impact these two major initiatives of the governor that they should be fully infused with practices that will reduce health disparities? And that leads me to say that I hope and echo some of all the other colleagues here around the table that have talked about social determinants, but it's not only social determinants that impact the outcomes of healthcare, but it's the organizational policies and regulations that are really going to make a difference. And I'm reminded in my own mental health clinic that is when we follow the State Office of Mental Health regulations, and we make a patient to come 3 and 4 times, already that patient is not coming back. It is a nutshell, because the regulations are really what it does is create obstacles to access of care, and I hope that we take that into consideration. And last but not least, I don't know for how long have we talking about workforce development, guys? And as we have been talking, then the diverse populations in New York State and New York City have increased tremendously. And we're having a hell of a time recruiting health and mental health and behavioral health practitioners who speak the language and know the culture of the patient. And I hope as a short-term goal, as we again look at the health homes and the VHOs, that care coordination needs to be done in a culturally competent manner, that this is just not using the IT, although I welcome technology. I think that that's the way that we are all going to be practicing. But care coordination, I don't think, is a substitute for case management. And I think that that's something that we want to improve the health, but reduce health disparities. That's something that we need to have. Thank you very much.
Can I just react to a couple of things? I happen to also be on the VHO subcommittee, and there were some concerns. You know, there's a lot of things happening very quickly, simultaneously. You need to know that everything you have indicated has been expressed on that committee. The committee also had some concerns around the timing of the RFP for the health home. But you will see, and I don't want to get too much into it because we have a presentation on health homes, but the concern was similar. The other groups are meeting. Our concerns are not yet in, especially with the TCOs, and the RFP is out there already. You'll see that the language is very broad to be able to include, you know, all the items that you have mentioned, including, you know, the cultural competency. This is something that has been discussed across the board. And not only that, but the whole behavioral health piece, not just mental health, but addiction and so on and so forth. So being a member on that team, I'm not a co-chair, I'm a member. We actually, there are some individuals in the audience that have attended, so they know they keep me honest. So I'm saying this. But your point is extremely well taken. It is a concern that we have. Let me just add one thing. I think that, you know, this is an important opportunity because we are here to redesign the Medicaid system. It's not just to send or submit proposals and evaluate it, and yes, we'll do this, no, we won't do this. This is our chance to really impact what's that Medicaid system going to look like, you know, down the line. So I really hope that we do take this seriously, come to the table with very tangible things that we could do And remember, yes, we're looking at a population. Is that Medicaid population? Because what's driving this is the reduction in the cost. But I also hear the concerns that in doing that, if we're going to address disparities, whether we're talking about an individual that's covered on the Medicaid or not, there's some basic things that we need to address going into this. So I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Taking up.
So, Lorraine.
Good morning, everyone, and I apologize for taking the 8:15. There were no more tickets on the desk. And I'm very happy to be here. I'm from the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, which is the single largest safety net system in this state. And so I am just amazed at all of what – I missed some of your comments, and I hope to be able to hear more of what each of you have said as we go along today. But for those of you who I did hear, I am just amazed at how much your comments resonate in terms of what we live every day. And very specifically, HHC serves 1.3 million people every year, 1.3 million people, and nearly a half a million of those individuals are uninsured. So I hope, and as the commissioner said, I hope that our conversation isn't just about Medicaid, because it can't be. It has to be about folks who are disenfranchised and uninsured. And on any given day or any given year or any, every 6 months, you're on Medicaid and then you're not. Mm-hmm. We hope we'd do something about that, frankly. So the points that folks were making about addressing the issues of individuals who are not on Medicaid but who still need access to health care and who still need access to housing is extremely important to me, given the role that we play. The issues in terms of health disparities, disparities because of, again, socioeconomic access, because of racial and ethnic race and one's ethnicity, because of language. I know that every day at any given HHC facility, there are hundreds of languages spoken, and I want to echo what folks said here. It don't come cheap trying to serve individuals in their language and trying to be accessible and responsive to individuals' culture and other concerns, and in terms of disability, and in terms of multiple morbidities. It does not come cheap. It is very hard to do, and I know that we may make mistakes every single moment of the day. But to aspire to do that is something that I'd hope that other colleagues, not just those of us in this room, but the rest of the system, would not only aspire, but be required to do. And so some folks, I think I heard when I was coming in the room, I think it might have been Jackie, that was going to those who serve individuals, who, or put to those organizations that actually serve folks who are underinsured. And I would hope that this group speaks to just what the policies are as it relates to the use of bad debt and charity care. And I know I would probably make some of my colleagues in the hospital industry pissed off, but I don't care. When you serve 450,000 people a year with uninsured, and in some cases, and in particular in our long-term care settings, when we're serving at any given time 600 individuals who are undocumented and uninsured and nobody is paying for them, you got to be bold and insult people. In addition, I think we also need to address the issues of access to housing, because housing is health care. I think, Charlie, you mentioned our irony of the term health home. It is ironic when we are attempting to provide appropriate health care that we have to struggle with where and when and how people can access what is a basic need of any human being, and that is to have a stable residence. And if, in fact, we are all going to approach actually changing health outcomes, we need to make sure that that people have a stable place to live, and then, at least we have a fighting chance to be able to make sure that services are responsive. That is not to say that we should not try to provide health care wherever someone is. And if they're on the corner, we should try to provide the health care in the corner, in the shelters, and wherever they are. But I think that we fool ourselves if we think that we're going to improve health outcomes or do away with disparities if we're not going to address the issues of the disparities or lack of affordable and accessible and responsive housing. I could go on. I've heard a lot of what folks have said here that address need. I do hope that we deal with some of the policies that seem to not only contradict but impede what are the stated principles in terms of Medicaid redesign. I'm heartened to hear the commissioner speak to the aims of hoping to inform this group and other groups to inform some of the major initiatives. I do know that there was a lot of discussion at the Behavioral Health Committee about health homes. I know there's a lot of talk about health homes. I just would hope that we not also, though, throw all of our hopes into one initiative. A health home cannot be everything to everyone. But I do believe that we look at, and I think it might have been Nisha who said that we try to look at every redesign initiative or a redesign policy with that screen of, is it going to facilitate access to individuals? Is it going to improve or reduce disparities? And if we attempt to do that, I think we'll have, come a long way. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. We have four work group members on the phone, and we would also like to hear from you as well. So could we start with Dr. Bhutan Foster? I'm not hearing Bhutan Foster, Dr. Bhutan Foster. So I think, is this? I think that
if you muted your phone, hit star six, and that way we can hear you.
Good morning, Linda. This is Becky Fuentes. I need
Minnie,
to schedule an appointment that my mother has for tomorrow at 11.
Dr. Bhutan Foster, is that you?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Excuse me, whoever is speaking, could you please mute your phone? Are there any work group members on the phone? Could you identify yourselves? No work group members on the phone. There's supposed to be four of them. And we have some kind of confirmation that that's true. Okay. Okay. To lecture mode, yeah. Okay. Okay. Thank you, everybody. We're going to switch. We're going to put you on lecture mode so we can't hear you.
The leader has turned lecture on, and your line will remain muted until the conference leader unmutes your line.
Well, we have the one of the things we're going to do this morning, or at least begin to do, is look at the workgroup charge. Everybody should have it in their folder. In your folder. And the commissioner and I have the task of facilitating a discussion on the charge and, a focus on whether this charge actually accomplishes what we want. It's within our purview to review the charge and make changes to the charge. So I think at this point, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think at this point, we've been around, we've heard a lot of tremendous great ideas that some, I'm going to be out there open and honest, because that's the way I am, and say that we will be able to address them. Others, we're not going to be able to address, so let's start off from that plate. But there's no reason why we can't include as a recommendation some of those items. The idea here is really to focus on the health care disparities and what comes with the whole health care piece. I heard housing. Housing is a big issue. And
but I'll be honest with you, I don't know that that's the charge in this group to address the housing needs. We will include it as part of the recommendations. I mean, we haven't talked. But, you know, how is that going to fit into the whole Medicaid reimbursement, rate settings, and so on and so forth? So I just want to throw that out there because I don't want to mislead anyone as to why we're here.
Excuse me. There was actually money included in the state budget this last year as part of the MRT, specifically around the issue of supportive housing, and it wasn't designated how that money was going to get used. I've talked with folk in the governor's office who have suggested that they recognize that a significant investment in supportive housing for people with chronic conditions would have a huge impact on Medicaid spending. So I appreciate that there's intended to be a work group specifically on supportive housing, and I think it is in our purview to talk about it and and inform that work group because housing does contribute so extremely to disparities in healthcare. And I know you were just pulling that out as an example, but I think it's
no. But we're saying the same thing. I mean, if that will be a recommendation that we will put forth, that the group decides, that's one of the things that's very important here. But it's not one of the charge as per this group, and I believe that's the way we were charged to do it.
Yeah. As we think about the charge of this group, one of the things that is important for us from the community level is trying to always remember that a big part of the problem of the healthcare system is looking at it in silos and compartments. And so to the extent that this group can bring up issues and recommend, we are author coordination and cross-fertilization of work and bridges between other groups because of the impact over here of what's happening over there, I think is very important for charge of this group to recognize. So
I'd like to just take another bite at the housing apple again because I think that it's so critical for us. We've spoken a few times about the lack of housing for people who are undocumented, who need long-term care. We have the top issue that we see among people with disabilities is homelessness and instability, which results in institutionalization at an enormous cost to the Medicaid system, as well as the enormous cost of deprivation of liberty. And there are programs that the Department of Health has had, like the Nursing Home Transition and Diversion Waiver that have, or the Traumatic Brain Injury Waiver that have tried to incorporate an element of housing subsidy in order to address community instability and people who are locked into institutionalization, again, at an enormous cost to the system. It isn't a perfect program, but really what it's telling us is that you cannot address some of these deep issues of disparities without addressing the housing issue, especially as we're looking at managed long-term care, we're looking at what the heck is happening with managed care, we're looking at health homes, all of these new models. How are we going to take what we've learned about the relationship between housing and healthcare into these new models? I think we need a very deep discussion of that.
I would also like to echo the sentiments on this and add the discussion about housing. It is not just those who are currently homeless, but those who are at risk and will be moving into homelessness because of the social inequities in our system. So, and I think everybody has said that one of the key issues for people who are homeless is access to care. And on the data that's been provided consistently through the state is if you pulled out the major health issues, it's so largely connected to people who are homeless or at risk of losing their home. Well, I understand that it is not a specific charge. I would also echo and really support that access and retention in safe, environmentally sound housing is critical to dealing with health disparities. I don't know how we have the conversation without recognizing that.
Asthma. I mean, how do you talk about asthma?
Asthma and the Bronx.
Oh, I just need to say that we have one long-term care facility, one public long-term care facility, that has 604 individuals out of the 1,900 individuals who are in that long-term care facility who, when they were admitted, did need post-acute care. But today, they don't need post-acute care. And their average length of stay is 4.6 years. Today, they need housing.
Mm-hmm.
They need some need supportive housing. Some just need housing,
mm-hmm.
right, with health care.
Right.
But they need housing. And our state and the federal government are paying $103,000 a year in that long-term care facility for those individuals. And we should not be paying, Medicaid should not be paying that level of money for those individuals. They don't need skilled nursing care. They need housing and health care. And so as we look at redesigning Medicaid, and I'm not sure if it is for this work group, but as you said, Commissioner, at least this group to recommend the acceleration of the convening of the housing group, but to recommend that the integral nature of housing to address not just health disparities, but to address sort of inappropriate health expenditure that could be being used in a much more effective way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think we need to clarify.
The
position that, I actually think we need to start working on, you know, the specifics of the charge, which can't be just in the restating of all 38 of these, right? So I guess that's the point is how to, you know, we need help in getting some focus. I think we hear the comments on housing. You drew a lot of like a magnet.
Yeah. well, that's a healthy discussion.
We
can just yes everybody to death.
Right?
We want to have a healthy, open discussion to make this the right process, right? So one of my recommendations would be, since our first charge is to look at what has been developed as the charge of this group, and it's my understanding that we do have flexibility in including expanding, you know, within the realms of health disparities, okay? Because that's what we're here, to address the health disparities. So let's look at this charge, see if there any way we could maybe include the housing piece as part of the charge in this group and tie it to the savings that we assume we'll get if we have this in place. I would think that
mm-hmm.
would be, you know, a good way of doing it, and that will be just one of the recommendations that we will have in addition to the others that will really focus more on the disparities.
No, I thank you for thinking of adding that, and I just suggest that in addition to cost saving is quality.
Mm-hmm.
Housing is related to pretty much quality of health care as well as cost effectiveness, like Lorraine has been pointing out.
Okay.
I wanted to suggest a few things related to our charge. We could include that we will address obstacles in policies and practices that have the effect of creating disparities or exacerbating disparities. We certainly want to be looking at reimbursement structures. We definitely want to be looking at provider efforts. We want to be also looking at how do we measure disparities, how do we measure efforts to eradicate disparities? What metrics are we going to use? What data collection are we going to do so that we can monitor over time what the effect is of various efforts? And I think we want to incorporate in the charge something about the information technologies, the electronic medical records, as well, there are some golden opportunities in what the state is doing that are really unexplored. For example, the electronic medical record system that's being developed doesn't currently have the capacity to record need for reasonable accommodations or language access needs, and those are gross oversights if we're going to be incorporating into the practice of care addressing the barriers that people face, their language access needs, their physical or communication or other accommodation needs.
I mean, I just want to underscore, too, what Susan said about data collection and how critical it is as we move forward. I mean, I was looking through some of the materials that were provided, and LGBT New Yorkers are notoriously invisible throughout all the information that was provided. We can't improve healthcare for not documenting their health disparities appropriately and accurately. And so I really want to underscore the importance of data collection in this work because it's going to guide the finished product for sure.
Can I just ask a process question about this charge? So I take it we're not limited to this charge. This charge is kind of like a little nudge in a direction because the charge is what the members of the work group just put up there. I mean, that's what we're basically saying. You asked us what the most important issues are. That ought to drive the charge of what we do, in my opinion. And I appreciate whoever put this together ahead of time, but it seems like it's a small piece of the scope of the issues that were sort of articulated by the group. So is this our work scope or is that our work scope?
This charge came as a result of one of the over 4,000 ideas and proposals that we got that was then transformed. And I know the person who did it is there and saying, no, that's not what I said, but we're not going to get into that. But it was one of the proposals that was translated to be this. It's Proposal 990, where it specifically spoke about addressing health disparities and developing, you know, rate settings and so on and so forth. So I believe that we have the flexibility to expand within the realm of the health disparities umbrella to identify other things. You're absolutely right. I thought it was important for everyone around the table to express what their concerns is because it's not just a one-way discussion, okay? But there are like 36 items up there, and some of them, you know, enter, but others don't. So I think it's our task to decide what are our main focus here in this group, and I think we have to start doing that sooner rather than later so that we could structure our discussion going forward.
And let me just interject that it's 12 o'clock, and I apologize we didn't stick to this agenda, but I think this was a healthier discussion than to go through the design, blah, blah, blah. And we sort of like did all this not even knowing it. So now I think we're pretty much framing where we're going to go from here. And so why don't we try to I'm going to get to the comments. I'm sorry. So what we're trying to do now before lunch break, right?
Lunch isn't until 1.
1. Oh. But then we have your report, which I think is important.
Yeah, we need to get that done before lunch.
Yeah, we have to get that done before lunch. So why don't we go around a little more? I know there are a couple of hands. And then let's try to really focus on what our charge is. And if it's any of those, that's fine. But let's narrow it down to just a couple. We can't have 35 different charges. Just doesn't work. Okay.
So if I could, it might actually be useful since
to go over those?
Since Kathleen went to the trouble of writing all of this
down, put them around.
If we could tape them up so that people could see, I think, in fact,
I think there are things we can group together.
Probably a majority of them actually do fit within the existing charge, and what doesn't fit within the existing charge, it would be easier for us to identify and spell out in a clear way.
Okay.
I wanted to just mention to the co-chair that it appears as though there are 4 people who are supposed to be here, and I think Denise is coming over from your office to get those folks on the phone, because there are 4 people who can't respond, but they can hear us.
Oh.
I did that when I left. That was the message I was getting. So
okay.
Somebody from your staff is coming over to get the right number.
Okay, so let's get the rest of the comments.
Okay.
So I completely agree that we should be able to clump a lot of those suggestions into the existing charge or at least into four or five buckets. And I think going to Ngozi's point earlier, I think it's important that we make the effort to do that so that those of us who are at the table thinking of disparities in a particular way don't feel like this is sort of for naught for us to be here. So I think it would be wonderful to have that. And I'm happy to also type up the list for folks if that's useful.
Great. Yes. Some comments that went around emphasized by several persons indicate that one of the key things that this committee can do because health disparities is a multifaceted problem. It's not just housing and not just employment. It's that the other work groups to work and make recommendations, that one of our charge should be to review and have some cross interaction at those recommendations that come out so that things that have the potential to do harm or dismantle or, you know, kind of have the equation messed up for reform can be identified and at least flagged. So as I look at the very first statement of this charge, I think that it's worth the while to add that as an overriding so we kind of bridge in this silo concern that we have.
Hi, I mean, I think if we look at this as kind of a framework, and these things, there are lots of ideas about what we want to pluck out that's in the general, because you can't put a whole bunch of things here, but the two pieces I thought were missing, one was exactly that, which is sort of monitoring the impact of the other working groups' recommendations on disparities, both positive and negative. That, to me, would be worthy of being an arrow here, because it's a larger statement. And the second thing I thought that might be added is that it came up because of the mention of the IT systems. The ACA does, in fact, have a set of mandates on states for things like IT and collecting data on race, ethnicity, and other, disparities, disability. So I think that making sure our job ought to be looking at the disparity segments of the ACA to also make sure they're being adopted in New York State and implemented. I think that would be another sort of mega bullet I would see added to this set. And then I think these are a harder challenge is, okay, what are we going to work on as a priority area? There may be some that people said that are completely outside this, but
So rather than focus, my suggestion was, I think with the addition of these two elements, this is pretty broadly written right now, undertake measures to address health. So that could basically encompass anything we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than spend in 10 minutes trying to decide what we want word on to add to this, let's spend the time this afternoon really trying to divide and conquer the work that we have ahead of us. So I'm suggesting that we don't spend too much time worrying about
the charge,
The language on here is pretty broad. We could add a couple of good comments.
Hopefully, by the end of the day, we could leave here with a real focus on what the charge is going to be and where we're going.
I think that's really the work of the afternoon to try and
Great. Sounds good. The only other comment I would make.
As I'm listening, I tend to listen for commonalities. Okay, and there's a list, language assistance, multilingual providers, and peers, because that's the direction I'm coming from, healthcare access, community-defined practices, health homes, data collection, issues in technical quality care. These were like the commonalities out of all of those that I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's more that other people recognize, but I think that's what you're saying is you want to bring it down to these commonalities, and these are the things that we would discuss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my comment was going to be around recognizing we're going to have to work hard between meetings to pull off the process that's going to be necessary to actually convey this information in a meaningful way, of course. And besides the topical areas, besides covering everybody –
we have to figure out, you know, what our priorities are. So it's, you know, it's one thing. I think that's going to be as much of a challenge as it is to figure out what's on the list is, you know, what's actionable, you know, what can you really actually accomplish in the context of this, you know, 2 to 3 month exercise that we're involved in. So I'm a pragmatist, you know, we want to accomplish something instead of just frustrating ourselves by creating a huge project that we have to end at some point in October.
But one of our products might be a recommendation for an ongoing process with community at the table, with community planning. Yes, we have a short window to come up with some recommendations, but what we can do is come up with a plan that includes ongoing consideration of additional measures to eradicate disparities and increase health equity. You know, I think it would be impossible to meaningfully address the very deep and historic issues that we're facing in a 3 month period, but we can definitely establish a process and a dialogue that, you know, that is attached to a plan that has, you know, measurement of what we're accomplishing.
One of the things that's happening, which, you know, again, I'm trying, like Ngozi, I'm trying to figure out, like, where we're at, us, like, here around the table. So while we're talking about this stuff, right, the health home thing is flying in from outer space that we have 3 weeks to put together, and DHOs are around the corner, and all these populations are getting moved into managed care, and we're going to kind of talk about, you know, how are we going to deal with disparities when a lot of these programs aren't constructed in ways that those of us who care and work in this issue every day are actually going to address. I mean, they're not constructed in ways to address those things. And so I'm kind of thinking like we're living in a parallel universe to what's actually happening in the healthcare system, which is there's rapid movement to take advantage of, you know, increased federal dollars and other things like that that's sort of being driven from an economic mode. But, you know, all of us live in that have been doing this work, have been doing it in a multifaceted way on the ground, have existing relationships, and that are that we've developed over years with community-based organizations, with housing organizations, with other things, and then with us as well. And all of a sudden now everybody's running around getting letters to be in everybody else's health home, and it's like everybody you talk to has no clue what is attempted to be accomplished here except to capture the 90% federal share for 1 million people, which is, believe me, we should not turn down that money. We should get it in our hands quickly. But I think some of the stuff that's going on is viewed, you know, at the community level as actually working against some of the organizing frame that goes on and that's already gone on. And I think we need to figure out how we're going to interact with that. Because you don't want to sort of feel irrelevant as you're going on, and things are changing in the state so quickly that nobody can really, you know, keep track of what's going on. I mean, people are throwing out proposals and, you know, people responding and trying to figure out who's going to be the BHO and whether that's related to the health home or not. And there's a lot of this stuff that we got to grab a hold of. And so I look forward to the presentation because I think it's going to help us figure out how what all of these things on the list fit into the models that are already being put out.
Your points are very well taken. And I said it before earlier that there are a couple of trains that have left the station simultaneously, and we have to try to, you know, work together, and somehow they are interconnected. I know it's not obvious on this side. I'm telling you, they're connected. So let's try not to spend too much time not focusing on what we're here, which is to identify the disparities and have our proposals in place. You will hear from the health homes what that's all about. It'll give you a better understanding of where we're going. But I think it's important that we keep focused so that we could come up with proposals that, you know, will be submitted and will be acted on. Now, nobody...
could our deliberations impact on the definition and requirements of the health home? Or are the two things now...
I think those applications
I mean, everybody's paying that for submission on September 1st.
But
exactly,
that,
that's why I'm raising the question.
Well,
is it possible?
But I think your point's well taken because the standards are drafted standards.
Right.
They're not final standards.
Right.
And I do think that we could take that opportunity.
I think that it would be very important if, again, it would take, like, balancing across Niagara Falls. It's going to be difficult. But, you know, can we somehow get some of these metrics, some of these concerns into those frameworks?
I mean, there's still, I mean, Lawrence, but I mean, just real briefly, I'll be spending more time on health homes shortly, I guess, but there is time to, you know, influence some of the health homes inspections. I mean, there are some large policy issues that we're still working out. We have a health home advisory group that we're working very closely with. We did a statewide webinar a couple of weeks ago. We're getting questions on, you know, on an ongoing basis through the health home website. And so we are, in fact, this is still a work in progress to a large extent, although you're right, it's moving at a very rapid pace for multiple reasons, to be honest. But there are still some big policy issues that we're working with groups on and talking about. Very little is signed, sealed, and done. And
Is the deadline tied to federal considerations and federal deadlines, or is that our own self-imposed
Those are the state's deadlines. Yeah, the application was released August 2nd. So I don't want to get ahead of your agenda either. So you know,
should we throw out concrete proposals and then just put them out to see whether or not we want them on our list? I mean, people threw out a lot of stuff, but things that could be very concretely done. Would that be a way to sort of?
Maybe I'm thinking that. I think we probably should move to the VHO proposal. I mean,
health home.
To me, it's different. Now you see how
let's not get them mixed up.
Let's go to the health home proposal.
And then we need to spend the rest of our day doing the vetting the specific proposals. And we were going to spend the rest of the day, but it would be nice to have the input from Lauren now on the health home, right?
I think it's better because now you'll hear exactly where we are, where we're going, and that will help everyone, you know, formulate your ideas and your proposals moving forward.
Okay. Can I just offer a question for later for the parking lot? I'm still working on the comment that Ngozi also mentioned before, which is how do all of the MRT work groups come together in a synthesis? What is the process of the group and how it gets vetted up for macro systemic decision making?
Well, at some point, and maybe we should have, and I didn't do that. Maybe we should have gone through what the process is. Okay,
right. But it could be late.
There's a good update that was just posted on the website a couple of days ago for the entire MIT process. So, you know, I would recommend that you look at that because it does, because frankly, you know, we're reacting to information that we get in the same way that you are.
Right.
The work groups are rolling out. There are several that haven't rolled out yet. So,
there was a question under there, too, you know, which is how much influence do we have around moving that process? So it wasn't just an innocent question. I'm not sure about the process. It was also how do I leverage the process? I'm sorry I wasn't clear.
You know, most of the subcommittees, if not all, most of the subcommittees have at least one or two of the co-chairs that are part of the larger MRT redesign group. So all of this will be vetted back up to that larger group, which is 27 members or whatever it
bigger
is.
Bigger now. It's over 30.
Yeah. Okay. Whatever it is. So to respond, I'm sure the process is going to be open just like the original process of recommendations. And I don't want to go ahead. I don't want to speak for Jason, but I assume that there will be some kind of process in place whereby, you know, the larger group would, you know, decide which, you know, items will go forward and which won't and that kind of stuff. But I can't tell you for sure.
And I would like to just respond that I think we would encourage you to voice your your ideas and interests to influence the way that that whole process is designed. You know, it's a work in progress, and those things have to be voiced. That's the point. We have a group, bunch of work group members who are going to have a bunch of ideas that we need to channel for you to the right places. So.
So I think we just, particularly on this point, we can take this back to Jason and just ask, I gather your question is, how do the different work groups interrelate now in the process of developing recommendations? Is there a way to do that? I'm not aware of a way formally to do that in the process. This group is scheduled to have 3 or 4 meetings, potentially a public hearing, and to produce recommendations for the full MRT for their consideration in November. So that's the task and the time frame for this group. Now, within that, we obviously can talk to the staff for the other work groups and see if there are ideas that are similar. There's going to be, you know, the other work groups that are formed or are going to be formed. So we can certainly take that back and see if there's a way, sort of in mid-process, to have some sharing where there are commonalities between the groups. That if there's a way to do that, we can at least share materials that the groups are working on and ideas. If not, have, you know, a call, cross group call potentially. I guess we could talk about that. But
no.
We'll take that idea back and see if we can come up with some ideas on how to address it specifically.
Just quick processing, and I appreciate how difficult it is to have all these different moving parts and to have to coordinate this in response to other moving pieces. But we didn't get any of these materials until just now.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel a little bit uncomfortable about prioritizing. I mean, we have some thinking to do. You know, if I had even gotten this sort of a day ago, you know, there are 4,000 MRT recommendations on the website. There's no way I could have looked at all of those ahead of time. And I know there's several community groups that we tried to have a conference call, you know, last week, and there were some great ideas. But we need to think them through. And just because we're on such a portion time schedule here, it's really important that we get this information as soon as possible. And again, I appreciate all the different.
Well, let me just say, the 4,000, that's, you know, from day one when the MRT was developed. I don't see how that really.
There's a
short listings of ideas.
It's just a sound.
It's
always been
on the web.
In the course of things, we were going to present this to you, and I realize it's short, you know, short time frame. But yeah, this is the meeting.
Like last week, for example, that would have been really helpful.
Well, but we have you know, a 3-month process lined out, so start now instead of last week.
I'd be concerned that the process would be closed to the proposals laid on the table.
So that's exactly the work that this group needs to do, is to look at what, you know, what's suggested before, what others have suggested, go back to your organization, set that, look at what the group has put up as their priorities. That's the challenge.
Let me just also explain that the idea here is to have 3 meetings, right? One in August, one in September, and hopefully one in October. This will be the lengthiest one. The kickoff is usually a whole day type of thing. The other 2 and possibly 3 will be 1 to 4, you know, 3 hours, 4-hour meeting, depending on where we are. The public hearing is new to me. We didn't do a public hearing in the DHO one. We figured that because it's open to the public and whoever wants to come in could come in, you can't participate, but you could hear. I don't know about.
Presumably that would be for us to decide, right, if we wanted to do a public hearing.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, somebody suggested it. I think somebody from the state suggested it this morning, so I only heard about it today, too.
Yeah, I'm hearing about it right now. But those are things we could discuss as we move along.
The question is, would a public hearing be helpful, and at what stage, and what would you expect to get out of it? So
the other piece is, remember, there's a reason why we have the experts around the table, because, you know, hopefully you come to the table representing the concerns and the needs out there. I'm just throwing that out. I mean, to have a public hearing, it's just going to put us back. But I throw it out to you guys. I, and I think we have the right people around the table to come up with the decisions we have to make, the proposals we have to make. It's up to you.
I just want to piggyback a little bit of what Pamela said before, but she was asking, how is it going to be the integration of this health disparity group in terms of the other meetings? But I have another type of integration question, which is the health homes are for physical health, behavioral health, and the intent is to reduce costs and improve quality. And the question is, and I just glanced at this, I haven't read it, but some of the data suggests to me that this is just focusing on health, physical health. The OMH is not at this table. And
only on race and ethnicity, not on disability or
LGBTQ. Right, but the question is, since the health homes, and if I remember correctly, the data on the 400,000 patients who are on Medicaid, you have a very large cohort of SPMIs, seriously and persistently mentally ill patients, extremely hard, challenging in their care. You have HIV-A, but the Institute, I mean, Department of Health has the AIDS Institute, so I can see some connectivity there. But what I cannot figure in my mind is, are we just talking about health disparity regarding physical health?
No.
Yeah.
And it's in the chart.
Right, but
how
are we going to integrate the recommendations here to OMH? How is that going to occur? I mean, it's easier, and we are delighted to have you, Commissioner, because for the chemical dependency, you're here, and obviously, you know, that's going to be filtered in. But how are these processes going to be integrated?
Right. For example, if we were to discuss barrier removal for people with psychiatric disabilities, in terms of policies and process of care, we would be talking about how is care integrated. We would be talking about what kinds of accommodations might be needed, for example, and how will staff be educated about those, like appointment times and things like that. So how would that get back?
It's just a process. I don't know how you guys are
going. So one thing we could do is go back and see if we can get an OMH senior staff person assigned to work with the group. I think that's reasonable. We have, certainly have a WASES and health.
And PWD.
Right. Well,
are we going
we can go back and say that there's interest on the committee and topics that oversee.
That's very weird.
Yeah.
May I ask you, are we going to have a parallel document from OMH to look at the
if I got to my data presentation, I would have said that what we have is incomplete and we're looking for the group to suggest other things.
Yeah.
So, yes, we can try to pull together more data on this. This was an initial attempt at what we had.
It's great
in
to
our
see
silo.
This. It's great to see this. And you have
yeah.
some other things within the Department of Health that I think would be very informative. And you've listed some federal reports that focus on some kinds of disparities but not others, but we could supplement that.
And that was
yeah.
the intent of this.
So we wouldn't be forced to make decisions about our priorities, et cetera, without having sort of a level playing field of having the data and the issues on the table.
We very much want it to be data-driven. And
of their strategic framework from 2009 to 2013, and I don't know if it's very basic. I was searching their site to see if they had anything about disparities or data or anything, and I couldn't find anything, but having somebody here would probably be...
Are you talking about OMH?
Yes.
Okay.
No,
We'll take it back and we'll make a discussion. I still think that we have enough individuals around the table that could address the OMH, could address the OPWDD issues without having to add a staff person from the department, because then the intent would be, you know, forcing the state agenda rather than the community-based organization agenda, which is what we're trying to do here. The community-based organizations that are here, HHC, Dr. Gill, you provide services to all this population.
Sure.
So I'm sure.
And so do we.
And so do you.
That's
and so does Promesa. So I do personally do not think
sure.
that there is a need to add additional staff to this group. I think together, and Dr. Buford, I mean, all of you, I mean,
Dr. Carrillo, right? So
yeah, I think that,
is another issue, and the data, you'll go back and whatever data you could present to us based on LGBT, OMA, mental health, maybe some addiction stuff as well, then that'll be helpful.
I feel like I'm being a little bit difficult, but actually, I don't think the point was that there aren't people around this table who know something about the systems. I think the point was that if someone from, if a senior staff person from OMH were here, they could on the spot actually answer questions, go back and collect information, help us identify what's real and what's just our perceptions. And I think that would actually be very useful from the two agencies, having someone from the two agencies who aren't at the table.
I'm trying to deal with the trains that are on the tracks already and what we're kind of talking about. And I'm wondering, in terms of the processes that are upcoming quickly, if there was, it's really picking up on your point, and maybe one thing that strikes me is that are we sure that the IT data collection systems are dealing with the federal standards on the differentiation, and that would need to include, I mean, that's very clear what they are. It's not, I mean, let's stay with the ones that say the feds are saying it's race, ethnicity, gender, and we could say sexual orientation to try to add that in New York. I think you wouldn't probably get that somewhere else, but in here it should be happening. If we're not getting it, we ought to start getting it. Primary language and disability status. The feds say you've got to do that. Do we know that that's happening? Do we know that that's incorporated in ACOs, in medical homes? I mean, the data collection ought to be differentiated in that way so that at least you can look for disparities later on. If that, those are getting out of the chute. Yeah, but I mean, that ought to go now, you know, it seems to me, because that's, we would all agree there, and there are going to be gaps, but we know a couple we want to say that ought to happen, but is that happening? And that's our first message to you. And then the second message, and this is kind of making it up, but I'm wondering, you know, we have these things called health impact assessments, and you've defined disparities here, and you could say inequality, inequity is fixable. I don't know how you want to play that. But could we say that we would like a disparities impact assessment on each of the recommendations coming out of the Medicaid working groups to really make them look at the have they dealt with this issue in their final recommendations? And while they're trying to figure that out, then we can, you know, get going on the details here. But, I mean, it seems to me that would be a message one, message two, so that whatever is happening, we put a marker down.
Right.
Removed.
We have our first two recommendations. Not even lunch.
Okay, so why don't we move to the BHO?
A health home.
I have to say the BHO.
Pregnancy.
Health
the one
home.
That's coming down on us from outer space, I think.
That
one,
right?
No, that was the health home.
Right, that's the health home. So I was actually, I'm going to sit here and do my presentation if everybody can hear me. Yeah. So I'm going to start on my presentation now. I was initially asked to overview the MRT process, talk about some of the larger initiatives and health home, but for the sake of time and the sake of everybody's interest, if you'd like me to just move on to health home. The meteor that's coming at us, I can do that. You can read for yourself a few slides in the beginning of my presentation that kind of just overviews the MRT process in general and highlight some of the other large Medicaid initiatives that came out of the MRT process.
Which one? I'm sorry.
This is the
page 11.
In your packet, you received a there was a PowerPoint presentation.
Managing
high needs Medicaid patients. Yes. So if you want to skip the first few pages, which also has some other initiatives you might be interested in, Health Home begins on what slide is kind of the cover page. So there seems, I hadn't planned on spending a whole, there's some slides here on Health Home, and then I can answer some questions if time allows. Health Home is an initiative that was afforded states as part of the federal health care reform bill, so through a state plan amendment. States may apply to develop health homes. We received some guidance from CMS and the Medicaid Director's Letter back in November that talked about health home being an important model of service delivery. And New York is really approaching health home as not just an added service, but a way of transforming the delivery system. And it will, in fact, have big potential, although I caution that's not a panacea. And I think that was addressed earlier, and I have to agree with that. And I love the cards we're working now to get things right. It won't be perfect from the beginning. We're going to have to work with each other to influence and change the process as need be. But it does offer some great opportunities to level the playing field in New York and to do some very important work. So this is the – so I'm going now to slide 13. Thank you, Eduardo. You know, we took a look at the Medicaid data, both the fee-for-service and the Medicaid managed care data. Under health home, we are somewhat limited in the population that's eligible for health homes by the federal statute. It's for individuals with two or more chronic conditions, one chronic condition and at risk of a second, or an individual with a serious persistent mental illness. So that is the population that we looked at. So in looking at the Medicaid data, we looked at the fee-for-service and Medicaid managed care. We particularly looked at those with PAERS, triples, and HIV/AIDS groups to look at what we found. And when you look at this chart, you see a great number of individuals with PAERS and triple chronic diagnoses. You also see the spend that is occurring to manage those conditions. And this first slide, and number 13 in particular, is a somewhat suppressed spend because it really only includes the managed care premium. It doesn't include the actual spend. So when we took another look at that group, thank you, you see that if you look just at the fee-for-service, which gives you a little bit more accurate picture of the spend of this population, it's a cost of $6.9 billion in 2009. So looking at those figures, there's some opportunities here for cost savings, but there's also great opportunity for quality of care improvement and improvement to access to care services and quality outcomes. So we took those that big population and we broke them into four buckets. We did this just for the simple effect of organizing this group, this population. It's close to 1 million people. We divided the buckets into the intellectual developmental disability group, the long-term care, the behavioral health, which will include people with just a mental illness diagnosis without any co-occurring conditions, as well as those with co-occurring conditions. And for lack of a better term, really the chronic medical. So the chronic medical group doesn't touch any of these other three buckets. They simply have chronic physical health conditions. And we looked at the patients in that group, the cost of serving that population, those populations, and that was simply, as I said, a way of organizing it. There are two active health home. I can say two. Well, there's the chronic medical and behavioral health model that I've been the most involved in and that I'll spend the most time talking about today. It's to really serve the populations that really touch those two bottom cohorts. In addition to that, there's a managed long-term care initiative around health home. With that, there's continuing conversation about other long-term care services. And then the developmental disability group is on a separate track because of the work that OPWDD is doing right now in converting in their partnership in converting to an 1115 and how Health Home may, in fact, fit into their larger vision that they're driving with the 1115 waiver.
Would you like comments or questions now, or would you like us to wait?
Whatever. I can take questions.
I just wanted to point out that coming from the disability community, the barriers between these buckets are really permeable.
Oh, absolutely.
They're very people
absolutely.
With developmental disabilities definitely fall into the behavioral health bucket.
Yes.
I wanted to communicate that people can be in more than one grouping and, in fact, you know, move from one grouping to another.
And I should have explained, we fully acknowledge this. This was just simply a way to
yeah.
try and organize and simply saying
okay.
that somebody in the behavioral health bucket simply does not really touch the developmental disability or the long-term care bucket. So that's not to say, so people in all of these
buckets really are have co-occurring conditions. So there are people in the long-term care with behavioral health and behavioral health and CBA. That's absolutely the case. Yes, absolutely. This was simply a first step.
If everyone is not as familiar with the developmental disabilities and behavioral health, might
these
be helpful for them
really
to recognize that people don't come in plain vanilla.
No, they do not. And these are not mutually exclusive buckets. They are simply a way of really just taking a look at the primary delivery system that we need to look at for health homes in this population.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. If this chart gave us the bucket information by race, ethnicity, primary language, the strategic implications would be quite different. So I just wanted to use this occasion to raise that possibility so that we begin to think about that.
Primary language or preferred language for healthcare services?
It does primary language. I mean, it's as if possible. I'm just using the federal language. I'm not refining it. I'm just saying what's in ACA. You've got them elsewhere. You see, you've got them in other databases, but they're not in this database, you know.
I'm not sure the primary is the language, though.
No, probably not, but we ought to start asking it, or sexual orientation. We ought to start asking it.
What disabilities fall into these various buckets as well?
The disability thing, I take your point. I'm not really just debating that at all. I'm just saying let's look at what the implications of knowing that in these categories would be for strategy if we did ethnicity, race, primary language.
This is actually just a snapshot of a million people.
No, I understand. Yeah. I just was trying to illustrate the point earlier.
So a precursor to Health Home is New York had engaged in a chronic illness demonstration project. And some people at the table are more familiar with another CIDP program. So we looked at that population in particular to look at some of the co-occurring, and again, you're right, it does not break it down by race or ethnicity or language, but we looked at conditions, and you can see the very close relationship between chronic physical medical conditions and mental hygiene conditions, both mental health as well as substance abuse conditions. And when you look at this, it's clear that people with mental hygiene issues have a high chance of having a co-occurring condition. When you go across, especially that bottom row, you can see that very clearly. And conversely, when you look at some of the more physical health-based conditions, if you look at the chances of having also a mental health or a substance abuse condition, it's upwards towards, you know, more than half of the people do. So that's the importance of Health Home, really, is to ensure that we are building a system that really wraps behavioral and physical health together, as well as social supports, rather than continuing a siloed approach to care, but in fact is an opportunity to rope them together. Did you have a question?
At a risk of being repetitive of Dr. Buford's comment, but we are part of the chronic illness demonstration in the Bronx. For 2 years we have done that and continue to do that. I think that if you plug in gender, race, and ethnicity, having done this and having quite an experience with the last two lines in terms of being on the ground, this chart will have a very different meaning.
I think there's something else here, which is you're looking at diagnoses. You're not looking at functional status. So you're not looking at people's activities of daily living and what barriers they may encounter in the health system as a consequence of those issues.
Yeah, this chart doesn't do that. You're absolutely right. This chart does not look at that. The CIDPs did look at functional status when it provided services.
Is that right?
Yes. And, in fact, Health Homes is going to be looking at functional status. At functional assessment, So that is part of the delivery system, but you're right, this chart itself does not look into that.
Well, that's exciting to know.
Right. So we also looked at this population, and we wanted to see where they were accessing, for those that are accessing healthcare services, where are they accessing their healthcare services? And really over half don't have any sort of medical home, and I don't use that in the patient-centered NCQA term, but just a medical home, a place to go to access their primary care services. They in fact, for lack of a better word, or for shoppers or occasional users, they're really hopping from setting to setting. They don't have a linkage. And so there's an opportunity here
to assure that people really get anchored into more quality and accessible care on an ongoing basis, not just for sporadic or emergency use. So when developing health homes, and just to explain the reason that that 860,000 number is a little lower than the earlier number, that's my fault, I wasn't able to update it in time for the meeting. Essentially, this number inadvertently excluded people with only a mental illness diagnosis. I apologize. But if you look at this population, we are looking at how to triage them in a way that you have a low touch. Everybody who needs health home services, let me just clarify, are in need of intense services. They're all in need of complex intense services. That being said, within that group, there's a variety of care coordination needs that primarily are somewhat driven by their functional status and functional assessments versus a diagnosis. You can have somebody who is extraordinarily expensive to serve, somebody who might need dialysis, for example. But if they're housed and employed and they really, are, although very expensive, really don't need a whole lot of care coordination services, and where you can have somebody with a mental health illness who actually doesn't have that much of a spend but in fact needs a tremendous amount of care coordination. So we're recognizing that. And so but this is, again, just a way to take this population and explain that we're going to have some people with more or less care coordination needs than other people in the population.
Sure. Yes. Just a question, since this, I understand, also has been an evolution over time. The chart has an end point and not necessarily a feedback loop if the person requires additional health homes. So is that built into the model?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I can take a look at that. No, I mean, there really should be an ongoing patient assessment. We're going to, you know, assign patients to health homes based on some sort of, you know, initial loyalty analysis. Do they have effective primary care in their life already? We don't want to destroy relationships that are working, but at the same time, get people anchored into something that don't have anything. And then there should be periodic assessments, both for functional as well as their conditions and their diagnoses. Are they ending up in the ED unexpectedly or for inpatient hospitalization? What are their ongoing needs? And that reassessment should be done. If, in fact, it comes to a point, and some people will always need high level of care coordination services. That is what they will need. Other people might come in with a high level of care coordination needs and after a period of time be able to transition into a lower level of care, but that reassessment should be done so that if they hit a point in their life in which they need more of that, they should be able to move back into a higher touch type of system. And conversely, if at one point somebody really doesn't need health home services anymore, there might be some people who, in fact, come in. I really think they're probably going to be a small percentage of the health home population, and they're being managed by a primary care provider, but, in fact, need health home at another point. There should be a way to just flow back in.
Right.
So that should be, health home should be able to kind of be flexible with the person. We think that's been one of the challenges with the tardy case management program. Is and one of the things that we are hoping health home can somewhat look at and address, and it's going to be an exercise for all of us, in what is the appropriate amount of care coordination services a person needs so that we see a real improvement in their quality of care without being fearful that if we decrease it, they lose access to all the services that they need, so that there's a little bit more fluidity in assessing the patient throughout time. I think we all know, I mean, somebody who's really is not precariously housed, and this has come up repeatedly, and we know this and working on health homes, that right off the bat is a much better starting point than somebody with precarious housing, if any housing at all. So that's the point of the patient flow. So we are looking for that constant patient assessment and for that flexibility in serving those patients.
Tell me if I'm going too far down a rabbit hole here in asking this, but I'm curious about two things. One, I understand once somebody's assigned to a health home, if they have the option of changing to another
rather helpful. But is the assumption that the state is going to assign every single one of these million people, or will health homes be able to identify people who meet the criteria and enroll them in health homes independent of an assignment? That's my first question.
Right now what I can say is right off the bat, the assignments will come from the state. That being said, we think a community referral system is very important, and we will be building that into the system. We just won't have it ready to go this fall.
And my curiosity about that also has impact for all of the targeted case management programs,
yes,
because presently it's a community referral network.
Well, the TCM program, right, I mean, the TCM programs and transitioning TCM into health home is something that we're working very closely with the AIDS Institute and OMH on, and there are some outstanding questions. But TCM, especially that first year, the ones that convert very much so will still have that type of community referral. So I'm really talking about kind of the non-TCM health homes. We need to build some sort of a community referral in, as well as look to what those community referrals look like for TCM, you know, next year.
Okay. And in terms of it becoming mandatory, I assume that's awaiting a federal waiver. Is that a specific waiver?
You mean mandatory for health home?
Yes.
Yeah, we're starting out with health home. Will be a passive enrollment assignment where beneficiaries will be assigned a health home and will have to affirmatively opt out as opposed to being asked if they want to join one. We just have learned through some of the CIDPs in particular, the retention once somebody agrees to become part of a chronic illness demonstration project has been very high, but getting that agreement has been difficult, and it will be very hard to funnel outreach and engagement activities to health homes without that type of passive enrollment. That being said, we are seeking an amendment to the 1115, which would allow a more mandatory assignment process for this population group.
I, based on the CDIP that we work on, I think that TCM are very helpful, but I don't think that you have the capacity in the state to turn that immediately. And needless to say, the amount of disruption for these patients, and I'm just referring myself here to the STEMIs, who already are challenged, and basically they have their own case managers, and if it's the first year, we are going just to use the CM coordinator as a substitute for case management. I hope that we are not going to see patients on FIFAD, like we did 40 years ago as a result of the institutionalization.
Can I just interject, maybe for clarity purposes? And I have to make sure I'm not, well, everything is out and the proposals are in, so I'm not disclosing anything. Remember, the behavioral health population, mental health, substance abuse individuals were carved out of this whole scenario for that reason, that we wanted to have some time to look at what does it mean for that population in terms of the health homes going down the line. So the BHO, which is the Behavioral Health Organization, is going to be the entity that's going to coordinate, so to speak, the care for that population in this process. Now, part of the proposal of the BHO is to maintain the TCMs or the case managers in existence right now, and that the health homes would work with, you know, these groups in the interim while we figure all that out. So it's not something like it's going to be overnight that these individuals are all going
Many of them will be, actually. I mean, they are going to be enrolled in health homes
right off the bat.
Yeah. Yeah, they're going to be part of health homes. Yes, but we are pursuing the TCMs,
right. The
ones that can meet the quality standards, the provider quality standards, and operational standards will become part of health homes, and there will be a transition period then for a year. And we are looking to maintain, as well as the CIDP, those connections in the health home assignment. Is that what you were?
Yeah, because you're going to use algorithms to assign
TCM
these patients.
Yes, TCM is part of that, yes. TCM and CIDP and other existing primary care connections, COBRA is another example. Those are part of the assignments that we want to maintain. So that's why part of the application process is talking about who's part of your health home,
sure,
so that we can
right.
take a really close look
at what those connections are and maintain that continuity of care, especially when it's working. We know we have some that we have to question whether it's working, but we have a lot that we want to maintain and build that in. So the next two slides really just show kind of examples of what the health home could look like. And in reality, a managed care plan and the BHO will have a role in this in terms of helping to, as the commissioner indicated, helping coordinate and maintain the care coordination of the beneficiaries within their system. But conversely, they will have a responsibility to assign appropriate assignments for their beneficiaries that meet health home requirements. And as well as the state could have a direct relationship with a health home, especially while we still have a large fee-for-service population that's not enrolled in managed care. Health home services are really only the care coordination services. Direct medical services, behavioral and physical, are going to be delivered as they've always been delivered. Really, health home is that attempt to get partnerships in service delivery areas to be working together. One of the things that's exciting to me about health homes is it is an opportunity to somewhat level the playing field between larger and smaller community-based providers. The community-based providers are in the community. They know their populations. They're probably more attuned to how to find people and engage patients into the delivery system. That being said, they've run into obstacles in getting appointments on time, getting access to specialists, just finding those connections. Conversely, we're putting a lot of pressure on some of the larger hospital systems in particular to reduce their ED and reduce their readmission rates. And they absolutely are going to need to partner with their community-based organizations. We expect housing at the table. We want plans at the table. So in our mind, a truly robust health home application is one or more hospitals, multiple community-based organizations, and a managed care plan. And the fewer partners there are, the weaker that health home is and the weaker that application is seen. We need to have that type of collaboration. At the same time, the state is really taking a little bit of a step back, which is somewhat unusual for us, in letting the health homes work out how they're going to make these relationships work. Our previous demonstrations have, in fact, dictated staffing ratios or how many face-to-face meetings versus how many telephonic touches everybody needs. It hasn't really worked. We're still in the system that we're in. It hasn't really worked. So this is an attempt to actually put out, and I don't have it with me, but it's on our website. It's in the state plan amendment, quality measures that we're going to be looking for health homes to achieve. And it's going to be more of an approach of, these are the quality measures. This is what you need to achieve. How you achieve them is up to you. Work with each other to work that out. And so it is putting a lot of pressure on the health homes, but at the same time, we also have gotten that feedback over the years. We've been told, you're micromanaging our business practices. We need more flexibility in how we address our patients' needs. So, you know, we're working together to strike that balance.
Two questions. This slide, I was trying to explain it to somebody the other day, and it actually confused me.
Oh, okay.
I thought I understood it, and I couldn't explain it. Is the assumption on that bottom, that third one, that plans will actually themselves be hiring and supervising care coordinators?
Several plans did that under the chronic illness demonstration project, and some plans have expressed an interest in doing that under health homes. Other plans have said to us, we're not really interested in being a health home. We're going to be more than happy to have them in our network. We'll be assured, we'll certainly be responsible for assigning beneficiaries to them, but we don't want to ourselves be one. And other plans, and this is where, it gets hard, if any part of this is easy, are saying that they could do more of the lower touch care coordination, maybe some telephonic care coordination, but are going to want to contract into their networks for that higher touch patient outreach and engagement.
So for those of us that work with multiple plans, imagine what that world looks like.
Yes.
Okay. Just imagine what that world looks like 12 health plans that we work with, and each one of them decides what role they want to play in the health home world, and we have to figure out what's left after that. So some of them that say they're not doing anything, well, we have to bring the care management piece in-house for those. Others are going to say, no, we really want to maintain this in-house, and we're going to go, oh, so we don't. And our patients, we're going to go, well, sorry, your care manager lives over there somewhere at the health plan. Oh, but this one we have care manager. That care manager's down the hall. I love the idea of letting, you know, all the flowers bloom, but it just, you know, it works for the plans. It doesn't work for the provider community. And for those of us who've
been... For the patient.
If we can't figure it out, and I will tell you I've had no fewer than 50 health home conversations with different people in the last, if we can't figure it out, the patients will never figure it out. And they have no idea who these people are. And if they're detached from their source of care, if they're not in your office, in our office, in the places where they are, then they will create disintegration of the delivery of the system. They have to be where the people are going.
They have to. We agree with that. If it's the plan, the plan has to be within those sites delivering.
I know, but they're taking control over that model in some cases and giving us control over that model in other cases, and that doesn't really work when you're a provider. Remember, we're talking about equity and equality and all of those issues. We have, as a provider, to give our job on the front end is to give the same care to every single person that walks in the door. And we can't do that if at a level above that, things are being integrated differently and people are making different choices and options. That just confuses us and confuses the patients who are getting care from us. We have to be able to say, here's how we do it. Here's what we do. And that resource has to be more consistent. So what we hear when we're talking to the plans, they're all trying to figure out what to do. But I'm thinking at the end of the day, what's left of that is the patients and the providers trying to figure out what the implications of all those different decisions are on how we deliver care. And I think that's what's making it so difficult.
It's going to be tough for the community to know, for example, if somebody comes to our organization, how are we going to know what to tell people about health homes and what to go into? Because it's different for everyone.
Yeah. They're going to be assigned.
Well,
where about that choice?
But they can opt out. Oh, can they change?
Where there are options.
Right.
I don't want to dilute that.
Right. I had a second issue, not so much with the chart, but I've heard both Greg and Jason talking about the need to have housing providers in these networks.
Absolutely.
There's one big problem, and I have brought this to the attention of several people on the behavioral health work group, and that is that supportive housing providers, depending which housing system you fund to, don't necessarily have control over who gets in the system, and that's something that's going to have to change if having supportive housing providers in your network is actually meaningful. So, for example, most of the housing we provide is under contract with HIV/AIDS Services Administration, not all of it, but most of it is. They have no triage system there, which means that a smart, very functional person who doesn't need supportive housing is able to jump the queue in front of somebody who has very poor functional skills, desperately needs it, but doesn't know how to work the system or the financial advantage of being in supportive housing. And so it would be a really very good thing if Health Home gave the leverage to change that so that, I mean, the whole point of having to the health home provider, presumably the whole point of having a housing provider in there is that if you identify somebody who has a severe need for supportive housing, you can actually get a placement out of it, and the larger structural systems, whether it's OMH or OASIS or HIV, don't necessarily allow that. I think this speaks to structural barriers that
inform disparities in care.
Mm-hmm. It's also true that not all of these people will qualify for supportive housing who are in need of housing. Supportive housing is for small segments of this population, not the entire population.
For sure.
Right.
For sure.
So there's a lack of eligibility.
Access to me.
So when you're saying that the assignments, they are going to be assigned to these health homes, and you're saying that the assignments will come through the state. What exactly are you saying?
Well said.
We're going through an application process now. Mm-hmm. The state will certify health homes.
Okay.
We will look at the patient population that qualifies for health homes, their geographic regions, their primary care touches that already are in existence or other case management or favorite ED or an assortment of things for an algorithm, and assign those patients to the health home. So the health home will get a list of patients that they are now their responsibility, and beneficiaries will get a letter explaining that they've been assigned to a health home.
So where will those actual assignments come from? Are they coming from the community? Are they coming from primary care doctors? Are they coming from mental health clinics? Where exactly are those?
Medicaid.
The Department of Health. From the Department of Health through Medicaid.
Yes.
So how are they identifying these people?
We've identified
this population.
The population's been identified by their by the diagnoses. That's the earlier charge. We've looked at the pairs of triples, HIV, AIDS.
So if you've got somebody with a mental health diagnosis and a hepatitis C diagnosis.
They've been identified
through their doctor.
Through the Medicaid data.
Through their Medicaid data.
Through the Medicaid data.
What meds they're on, what doctors they're seeing, things like that.
Yeah.
So I'm throwing this out here. What if a person is not comfortable with that?
As we talked about, where applicable, it's a passive enrollment initially.
Okay.
And so the people will have an option to either opt out or to choose another health home. But we are looking also to do patient engagement and to do a mandatory assignment, much like managed care in health homes. Yes.
I have a question that might be somewhat off the beaten track here, but it's related to everything I heard. I know that in the presentation here, there was no mention of the perinatal population. My question is based on my experience in service delivery. Based on what we know of the perinatal field, what we observed and what the science and research is showing, is that that population, pregnant or childbearing age women and men who are connected with childbearing women, sometimes the first interaction with the medical system is around that age. And I didn't see any mention of the information here. That's the first thing. The other thing is that the emerging, or at least information that I've become aware of recently, is showing that primary prevention services, and this is wellness promotion, not sickness prevention, not the what we term as preventing secondary disease, is a big needs to be a significant focus in reduction of cost for care and in redesigning any wellness promotion system. Our medical homes and the way they are going to be reimbursed or whatever, or they encouraged and expected to address the issue of primary prevention in the communities that they serve, and particularly with respect to preventing foodborne outcomes, which can still be, if you look at your slide 13, a lot of the what you're measuring in slide 13 here with the developmental disabilities and behavioral health issues and chronic medical care, it's precipitated from that very early experience of a woman who gets pregnant and is not well cared for before she gets pregnant. Now even a young girl at puberty who doesn't get her body cared for before she gets the pregnancy can build your boxes, build your numbers in here very quickly.
Right.
So is any of that
concern? Yeah, I mean, it has been. I mean, with the federal statute being what it is, we have to enroll people that already have chronic illness and disease. So being pregnant or being a woman of childbearing age in itself does not qualify you for health home services. So a woman who does have two or more chronic conditions or a mental health illness and, in fact, is pregnant will, in fact, be in health homes or should be in health homes. And obviously the perinatal needs that she has in her life should be addressed by the health home.
So
but being pregnant in itself is not, or being at risk of a high-risk pregnancy or being in a high-risk group for a high-risk pregnancy, those in themselves do not qualify somebody for health home services.
I'm going to interrupt now, and we have to break. It's 10 after 1, and we have a lot more to do, so we really need to break. Lauren, are you going to be here, or are you taking off at the break?
No, I'll be happy to stay.
Okay, great. So we don't have to do a full hour or lunch break, do we?
No.
And we were running significantly behind on the agenda, so I don't know what the lunch instructions are, so I'll let someone else
do
that.
Yeah, I
do.
I'm Kathleen, and I actually work here at Oasis. So 7 or 8 of you ordered lunch ahead of time, and so that is being served in rooms 4A and B, and I'll show people where that is. There's also a cafeteria, a cafe downstairs. And there's, as you can see where we are, a lot of places to eat here on Western Avenue.
People should eat in the building probably and bring food back.
Yeah, we want to have a 30-minute.
We have an area for you to eat. It's in 4A and B. So.
Okay. Great.
Do you want to try to get people back here by 2?
Let's just do a 30-minute. Yeah, 30 minutes instead of, so 20 to 2.
Okay,
yeah.
20 to 2. Okay, and I'll show people where 4A and B is if you ordered your lunch.
What?
So I'm going to have one fee-for-service patient that gets assigned to Affinity, another one that gets assigned to New York City, another one that gets assigned to Metro Plus, another one that gets assigned somewhere else. Okay, but I can also go to my meeting. So, no, get that. So, they've got most of their chances, and I'm in here, and I'm doing the tax, and they're going to auto assign them to someplace. I mean, you need Fidelis where we don't have
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted. The leader has turned lecture on, and your line will remain muted until the conference leader unmutes your line.